This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 62. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, a podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this first week of the year, Mike?
I'm sitting next to a barrel of beer.
Is that right?
I'm sitting in my home office. My wife got me a home beer making kit for Christmas.
Oh, that is cool. Awesome. How long does it take to ferment and all that?
The marketing on the box says 2 weeks, but the reality is it's four plus. It depends on, you know, how much time you want to give it. It recommends a minimum of 7 weeks for like the first stage, and then another, or sorry, 7 days for the first stage, then another 7 days for the second stage. And then after that, you can condition the beer for however long you want. But, you know, you make multiple bottles of it kind of all at the same time in a single barrel. So obviously you're putting them into different bottles when you start bottling it. But it's kind of unclear as to how long that conditioning process should actually take. And I think it's more of a trial and error sort of thing than anything else. As I said, the marketing says 14 days, but it's really month plus.
Right. 14 days if you want to make really crappy unconditioned beer. And if you actually want it to taste good, it's four weeks or something.
I think so.
Well, cool. I'm just coming off vacation. I had been off for probably, I'm trying to figure out exact, probably a week and a half. I was going to be off for, and I will be off later this week as well, but I'm kind of coming back to work because I wanted to record the podcast. I had a mastermind meeting this morning, and then I have like between 4 and 6 hours of hittail work left, and then the new site will be ready to go. And my goal is, you know, is to have it done by the second week of January to launch it out to the customers. So I just have such a tiny amount. I worked many two in the morning nights before vacation in an effort to get this done, because I really didn't want to have the 6 hours, right? I wanted to get it all done at once, but just couldn't swing it. So I'm very excited. I finally got the new design integrated into the back end, which was it was definitely more difficult than I had anticipated. I don't regret doing it. I look at my other options, which were to hire someone to do it or to have it rewritten in another language. And both of those would have taken 5 to 10 times as long. In the end, it took me a little over a week. And since I'm on a pretty hard, you know, hard time frame right now, I'm glad that I did it, but it was a big, man, I put everything else on hold. I have tons of email to answer and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I remember we talked about possibility of porting it completely to a different language. And, you know, you pointed out that it's really just not worth it to go to a completely different language.
Yeah. And even, you know, I started speccing it out before I started integrating the design into the app itself. I started writing a spec because I was going to hire a developer to do it, to basically rewrite it in ASP.NET or ASP.MVC. And sure enough, the deeper I got into that spec, the more I realized how complicated these pages actually are, even though they seem to be simple grids with sorting and paging. You know, hey, you can do that in 3 lines of jQuery. I mean, that's totally what I was thinking. But as I got deeper, I was like, wow, there's some really complex stuff. I still have a spec that's probably 60, 70% of the way done. So if I ever, you know, need to revisit it, but it gave me a good idea. I mean, I guess this is where that whole, you know, how there's the specs argument. Should you write specs? Should you not? What's nice for me, I write really lightweight specs for outsourced labor. I have developers who work for me and they're solid developers, but I can write really lightweight specs, but it allows me to fully think through the problem. And if I had not done that and had just gone with the no spec approach, you know, I know 37 Signals talks about that and a lot of other people, and I had just started moving forward with it, I would have probably gotten a couple days in and then realized that this was way more difficult than I thought. I don't know. When I do stuff myself, I don't tend to write specs, but in this case, it actually helped me out quite a bit. So I was glad I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And honestly, I think that's exactly the problem that I've run into with Audit Shark over the past year or so, because mm-hmm. I didn't write a spec for most of it. I just kind of mentally had it in my head. Oh, this has got to get done. That's got to get done. And I never really dug far enough in to write a full-blown spec to really figure out exactly how long most of the stuff was going to take. So a lot of it, I just said, oh, it'll take me, you know, 3 or 4 days to get through that, or a week to do that. And the reality was it took me significantly longer just because I really wasn't thinking through the full problem the way that I should have been.
No, exactly. And even lately, you know, as I was writing code and trying to figure out how I'm going to make all this work and trying to plan out the timeline, my spec for myself at least consisted of a couple sheets of paper and bullet points of task items. It could have been in Excel as well, but I just happened to do it on paper. And then writing, you know, hour estimates next to it and breaking them down into tasks that are less than a day. And it gave me a much better idea of, I mean, I know people who don't even do that, right? It's all in their head. And I don't know if that's how you did it or not, but I feel like that's really cruising without anything if you don't even have a bulleted list of tasks to left to go, you know, your burn down chart type thing.
Right. Yeah. So what I did was I put everything into Fogbugs as individual cases. And some things were really high level that I just kind of left as placeholders. And I knew that it was more of a major undertaking. So I just kind of left it as is and just said, implement X. And then there were other things where I went a lot further in and I implemented maybe 10 or 15 different cases for an individual feature that I wanted to accomplish. So I dug a little bit deeper on some of it, but other things were just kind of a one high level case that I would kind of state. And then as I started working on it, then I would start generating more cases out of that.
Right. Hey, I had this tip I wanted to give listeners. With this Hittail migration, there's the app side, which is the back end reporting. Once you log in, that's what you see. But then there's the front side, which is all the marketing stuff. And normally when, you know, these days when I build a SaaS marketing site, it's a handful of pages, right? It's like 5 pages, homepage, tour page, pricing page, maybe features, contact about, and maybe an FAQ. You know, it's really a short list. Since Hittail already had a couple hundred pages of content, the tip is if you're acquiring a website and you're going to migrate the pages to a new design, go into Google and type in site colon and then your domain name. So S-I-T-E colon and then hittail.com. And it will show you all the pages that Google has indexed for your domain. In essence, it shows like 1,000 or 2,000 pages indexed. So when I first ran that query, I was like, oh Lord, I have so many, you know, so many pages to migrate. But it turns out the bulk of those are forum posts and blog entries, which is cool because since those are blog and forum engines, you can kind of just change a theme and you're golden. Turns out there's somewhere between 150 and 200 actual physical HTML pages, HTML and ASP pages. So what I did next is I hired a developer. He went through and migrated all those pages to the new design, but he's not a design expert and definitely not a marketing guy. And so what I then did is I went into Google Analytics and to get maximum use of my time, since I didn't want to go through all 150 of those pages, I looked at the pages, the content that gets the most hits. And so I took the top 20 to 30 pages, and those got at least 10 views a month from search engines. So I know people just kind of wander into them. And what I did is I took each of them and kind of, first of all, I made sure they all looked nice, and it did take a little bit of tweaking here and there. Second of all, at the bottom or at opportune places, I put a like a nice button that says now try our plans, or now check out our plans, or now try your 30-day free trial, depending on what the page was and what it was talking about. So the idea is that I'm trying to take this wide, you know, this long tail of search traffic that I'm getting, and I don't have time right now this week to fix everything. And so what I did is I took the low-hanging fruit, the thing that most people see, and I'm funneling all of those users back into my main funnel that is really hardcore, good information about the product, and that's going to encourage people to buy. You know, it basically encourages them to do the free trial and such.
Very cool.
You talked to a prospective customer last week?
Oh, yes, I did. I was able to get in and schedule a meeting with somebody who I'd been kind of in contact for throughout the past year or so. And I came into his office, talked to him for probably about half hour, 45 minutes or so, and started walking him through Audit Shark and showing him exactly what it was, what it did, and how it could apply to his environment based on our one of our previous discussions. And what I found was that what he's really looking for is more or less a vulnerability scanner as opposed to a configuration management product. And from that, I kind of extrapolated a little bit and I said, well, wait a second, maybe I'm missing the mark a little bit. I walked through the path of what the progression is for people addressing security in their environment. And I kind of realized that it really put it in perspective when I was talking to him and showing him Audit Shark. That progression is essentially IT managers start out with patch management because it's really the lowest hanging fruit. And then once they they've got patch management under control, they start looking at vulnerability management. So they start looking at things that there aren't necessarily patches for, but they want to be aware of those things so that they can, you know, address the risk with whatever the vulnerability is. And then once they've got that under control, they kind of go to an advanced level where they're doing configuration management. Now, AuditShark can do all of these things, but I was really thinking of addressing the configuration management piece, not necessarily the patch management or the vulnerability management. And based on our conversation, it almost seems to me like I might want to, I guess it would be shifting gears a little bit to go more towards vulnerability scanning and patch management scanning versus going for configuration management. Because like I said, the product can do all three of those. It's just really a matter of how do I want to market it to people.
Sure, that's true. So it's like positioning more. Now, is it set up right now out of the box that you could do vulnerability scanning patch management, or would it take actual code, different code?
No, it can do it. I'd probably have to build some specialized reporting. I need to enhance the reporting in the product anyway, so it's not like that's really a big deal.
Right, it's pretty weak right now, right?
Yeah. So if I wanted to do that kind of stuff, it's not a stretch for it to go after those areas. Because really, when you talk about something like patching, how do you determine whether or not a specific patch is installed? Well, on Windows, it's fairly straightforward. You look at the registry and you figure out whether or not that patch has been installed either through the add remove programs, or you go to where the files are supposed to be located on the operating system, look at those locations and check the versions of the DLLs or the executables. And if they don't exist at all, then chances are you don't have the software installed that, you know, requires that patch. If they are installed, you check the version numbers and say, do they match this? And if not, are they of a lower version? And if so, then you have to have this patch. So it's really not that much of a stretch to make the product do that, because the product is capable of all of those things. The difference between configuration management and vulnerability management is really just the rules that you write and what you're looking at. And because the core engine can do pretty much anything on a machine, I have the capability to do that.
So the good news is you have the capability. The other good news is you get to talk to more customers to figure out if they, right? Because you don't want to go on one customer's recommendation. So you get to go talk to how many more? Do you think you're going to talk to 5?
I think 5 on the high end, probably 3 to 5. I don't know if it'll be more than that.
I think it'll be interesting to hear how it pans out as you go. If one guy says, oh, we would totally want it for configuration management, you know, what you do if you just position it as configuration and go there first, or how you handle that. So
yeah, I think it really depends on what foot I want to lead with.
Absolutely.
You know, because I've looked out there at some competitive products, and some of them say flat out, we do vulnerability management and configuration management. It doesn't seem like too many of them combine patch management as well, but it's certainly possible.
Sure. I would lean towards getting really good at one. I mean, especially since you're one person trying to do this, and it's probably teams doing the other, your competitors. I imagine it's larger companies. I would consider really focusing on one and positioning as like the best X instead of we do X and Y. Look at us. We're kind of good at both, but not great.
Right. I know what you're saying. But as you said, I mean, it's all about market positioning at that point, because it's not a technological problem for AuditShark. It's a matter of how it's viewed by people and how do I want to pitch it to people.
Right. I wanted to give a shout out to Rudy at hireflow.com. That's hireflow.com. I just wanted to thank him. He sent me a really nice email that was, you know, I'm very experienced with MVC. He has his own startup, which is hireflow.com. He just offered to basically have a conversation with me in terms of if I decide to move to MVC, things I need to look out for and things I should keep in mind. So I just appreciate that. It's cool when listeners do that, you know, offer their time for basically for nothing, just to help us out. I'm stoked, man. We got 71 ratings in iTunes, and most of them are, I think, 67 or 5-star. Then we have a bunch of new comments from November and December, and there were some really cool moments. One of them says, it's from Tess Falcon, and it says, I love this podcast. I've heard too many stories of 16-year-old millionaires and the never-failed-at-anything stories. These guys seem so much more believable since they didn't get started until they were older, didn't hit a home run with everything, and actually failed before they were able to put the pieces together. And then the other one, gosh, there's about half a dozen. I won't read through them all, but This one said it's from Wood and Wireware, and he says, listen to your episode 6 and updates today after finding you guys in a browse for interesting dev-related podcasts. Episode 6 was really helpful, particularly the when to pay someone to help you. So I'm surprised the guys stuck around, because from what I recall, our first half a dozen episodes were not very good.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because when I ran out of podcasts, I started listening to our old episodes, and I thought I'd be... I really thought I'd be completely appalled, and I wasn't.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, so that's the thing. I haven't listened back to them in a long time, in over well over a year. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling stiff doing them and feeling kind of ashamed of putting them out. Right. Well, that's good. You know, I need to go back and listen to them so that I stop saying that. Because if they're not that bad, then I need to not rag on them.
Yeah.
Some people might yearn for the glory days, huh? They're like, the first 10 were the best. You guys are terrible now.
Yeah, the first one was, it seemed a little bit stiffed, a little bit forced, but I think after that, things straightened out pretty quick.
Yeah, so we got a bunch of new reviews. We encourage folks, you know, this is what helps us rank in iTunes, which gets us more listeners, which encourages us to basically to continue doing the podcast. So if you haven't been on there, would love a 5-star rating, a comment, all that stuff is just awesome. And like I've said before, we have such a high number of comments and ratings compared to other podcasts that have many more listeners than us. So we know that that's you guys out there. We appreciate it. Basically, we're going to be answering as many questions as we have time for. As we talked about last time, we still have a big backlog of listener questions from the past several months.
Right.
It's been cool doing this every week. First question is questions to ask a web designer prior to hiring. And this was on Twitter, and it's from @ReedTree. And he says, questions to ask a web designer prior to hiring from the point of view of a consumer wanting a website made. In essence, I ask very few questions to web designers. To me, hiring a web designer is the easy part because they have visual experience, right? They have a visual display that you can look at and say, do I like that or not? Hiring coders, 10 times harder. Even for me who write, you know, I'm a coder. It's still really hard to evaluate and all that stuff. But for designers, the first question is always portfolio. Like if they don't have one, they're a no-go. So the first thing I look at is how much I like their designs. The second thing I ask, obviously, is rate, because budget is important. I have 4 different designers I use depending on the project. Well, 4 different ways I will design a site. The lowest end is WordPress and getting a premium theme. That's under $100. But it's a little cookie cutter. It's not nearly as nice as the other 3 designers that I have, you know, who go up to 10 grand for a website or more, depending on how big it is. But with the Hittail design, I went with my high-end guy, and I paid, the front-end design was 6 grand and the back-end was a couple grand. And then it was PSD to HTML was, you know, probably 2,000 to 3,000 more, because I did get high-end or low-end HTML and I wanted super slim down markup and all that stuff. So I've never spent that much on a design, but I totally don't regret it. In my opinion, it's a good design. The other question I would ask beyond budget is, how long do you take to deliver designs? How many revisions do I get? That's pretty much it. And typically, I will have a Skype call with someone, even though I don't do Skype very much, tend to do email. But when I'm hiring someone with like a designer, I really need to know that we can work together. And it's good to have just a little bit of face-to-face so that the person understands kind of where you're coming from, because you're going to have emails. We're going to be critiquing their work. And I always want to have a little bit of a relationship with them when I'm doing that. I don't tend to spend too much time worrying about what to ask when hiring designers, because I do find that people who do really good design tend to deliver well for me.
The things that are important to me, at least, are the number of revisions, because some people will hand it over, and depending on who the designer is, I mean, if they're, you want to avoid somebody who's a little bit flaky, where they're just like, oh, this is my work and it's top notch and you get what you get. So you do have to be a little bit careful. I mean, most designers are not going to do that to you. If you've never worked with designers before, you just have to be careful you don't get stuck with that. And then the other things are pretty straightforward. The only other thing I've thought about asking on occasion, but I've never really dug too much into it in conversations, is what their workload is like, because I kind of want to know if I have revisions or changes, or if I'm under a time crunch for something, are they going to be able to respond in the time that I need?
That's a good point. You know, there's a difference between turnaround time on revisions, which you're hoping is like a day or less, ideally. The best designer I've worked with, you would turn around in a couple hours, which was just sweet. There's a difference between that and the total timeline. You know, you can kind of ask a guy, what's the typical timeline for your average 5-page website design? And they should have an idea, right? If they're experienced, they do this all the time. They know that it takes from your first description of it to when he delivers PSDs, it could be 2 weeks, it could be 4 weeks, depending on his workload.
So I think it also depends on what their typical timeline is for the mental discovery phase. You can describe something to a designer and they can say, okay, I've got an idea of what you're looking for, at least conceptually. Let me think about it for a little while. And while they're designing other things, maybe they toss around some ideas in their head, or, you know, they're out to dinner one night and they're just kind of thinking about it, not too in depth, but the, you know, something just kind of crosses their mind. Hey, that would be a great way to do this particular project. So, you know, you may get one designer who says 3 weeks and the other one who will say it'll take me 5. It's not like it's actually taking the person an extra 2 weeks. There's time that they kind of build into that for more of the creative process than anything else. And that's, as you said, that's not necessarily as important as what their actual turnaround time is once you get to the revision phase.
Right. And I think the other thing I'll point out is these days I've found that a lot of designers only go to PSDs. And then there's this whole other subset of folks very specialized who are doing PSD, slicing them and turning them into HTML. And 5 years ago, my experience was there were a lot of designers doing all of that whole, even 10 years ago, especially doing that whole gamut. But I've found that it's become more specialized. So I would recommend actually, if possible, finding a designer who just goes to PSDs and then using someone else who's very, very good and specialized at PSD to HTML. And we actually have folks we recommend inside the academy for that stuff. And if someone has a question, they can, you know, email me directly. Question number 2 is examples of coming soon pages. So this is from Sumit Gulecha, and he says, thanks a lot for the podcast. They've helped me and inspired me. Based on your advice, the first thing I want to do is get the coming soon page out and start collecting emails. Good move. There was a question about this that you answered on a recent podcast. It was helpful, but I have a further question. I'm wondering if I need to tell people about myself, my background. I got the gist of your answer that the goal is to tell people just enough for them to be able to decide whether or not to sign up for the notification mailing list, but I expect to figure it out soon as I proceed, but it will be helpful if you can provide some examples. So I'll answer his question about providing background about yourself. It depends. I would lean towards not, especially if you're selling a product like a SaaS app. People care more about what does it do. They don't so much care about who you are, what you do, and until you ask them to buy, then I would prefer that you have an about page with a picture. You know, it kind of makes it more personable. At this very early stage, I would tend not to do that. The exception, the reason I say it depends, is because when Mike and I put on MicroConf, we did mention on that page who we were, because if people are going to be interested in a conference, they do want to know who's behind it. And the fact that we both have blogs and podcasts and run the academy and have startups, I mean, this stuff is important to people. So we actually just linked out to our blogs. And when I did my landing page for my book, and if I do future, you know, products like that in the future, I always have a down at the bottom, you know, hosted or written by Rob Walling or something, just that kind of mentions, because I do have some name recognition in the sphere. And so the name actually is important.
For most products or most applications, you're not going to want to bother putting your own personal information on there, especially if it's just a coming soon page. But once you get down the road where you have got people onto your mailing list and you start emailing them, talking to them about the product, and then when launch day comes along, when you're trying to actually sell to them, they're going to want to know who you are. And for MicroConf and even your book, I think those situations are a little different in that those are a bit more personal.
Yeah, it's almost like they have something to do with personal branding. We do have some type of name in this space. And so if you somehow had written a bunch of articles for veterinarians and you were known in that space at least a little, and you're putting out veterinary software, then of course you're going to lend your name to it a little bit, right?
Right.
You know, be the foremost thing, but it's like if people know you in that niche, then yes, it's probably worth something. Or if you have some specific experience that's really relevant. But even then, we didn't put an about page, anything like that, on MicroConf. It was like one sentence. And it said, brought to you by the guys behind Startups for the Rest of Us and the Micropreneur Academy, Rob Walling and Mike Tabor. And it linked out to our about pages, like our you know, respective blogs or blog about pages. So I don't think you want to add a bunch of clutter. Landing pages should be pretty darn slim. It's not until you get to the full site that I would recommend building out a full about me page.
Yep.
And if you're, Sumit also kind of asked about landing page examples, and there's some really good examples on unbounce.com, and we can link that up in the show notes. But frankly, if you go to Google and type in landing page examples, you'll see some pretty quick. There's also a lot of pretty decent WordPress themes at ThemeForest and WooThemes that are landing page themes. And so you can kind of filter through them. And even if you don't use WordPress, they still look attractive and they show you, you know, give you an idea of how much text looks good on those pages.
Speaking of WordPress, and it's completely, you know, not relevant to this, I doubled the load speed of some of my WordPress installations.
How'd you do that?
I cut out some of the plugins. So, for example, there's the Jetpack Analytics that was kind of bogging things down. Then I also used the Contact 7 plugin.
Yeah.
And I found that the Contact 7 plugin loads a lot of CSS and additional files that don't need to be loaded on every single page of your site, even though you only use the Contact 7 plugin for one page, for example, like your contact page. It gets loaded on every single page. So all those extra files get loaded every single page. So there were several plugins where I found that that was happening. So I had to go through them and tweak some things, and I'm actually going in with my with DreamHost right now and asking them some questions that I just got an email a little while ago saying, oh, this is potentially why some of your images are loading a little bit slow.
Got it. Well, I'm going to need to talk to you more about that, because my DreamHost virtual server has been eating more and more, you know, processing power and such, and I just keep cranking it up, and I know that it's got, has something to do with, or I imagine it has something to do with my WordPress installs.
Yeah.
And I have gone through and disabled some of the plugins, but I use Contact 7 on a few. I didn't realize it was hogging so many resources.
Mm-hmm.
If you find someone to hire to just handle that stuff for you, let me know, because I need someone, you know, good who can just go in and do this kind of stuff and optimize and all that.
I was seriously thinking the exact same thing and just hiring somebody to do that. But
yeah, well, I started to look on Odesk. I started a post one day and then I got sidetracked with Hittail stuff. So of like someone who knows DreamHost and knows WordPress and can go in and do stuff without breaking it, but that can make recommendations to me of like, I think we should do X, Y, and Z, X, Y, and Z. And then that person can then go do it. You know what I'm saying? Like the whole deal. I just want you to be a consultant and to take care of everything. So,
right.
Question three is a quick tip, it says. It's from Sean Murphy. He's written with several questions, and he has a landing page at hvacpracticetests.com. And HVAC is, it's like mechanical contracting. So there's electrical and then heating, ventilating, and air conditioning is what it is. And obviously there's a test that people have to pass in order to become a contractor. He says the primary goal of the page is to collect email addresses, and he had a secondary action that he wanted users to take, which was to complete their survey. And originally he had just added the link to the survey to the bottom of the page with a bit of a call to action copy, but obviously it wasn't working because people were entering their emails and going through and never coming back. So he changed the success message after the user submits their email, and instead of saying, okay, we'll be in touch, it says, okay, we'll be in touch, now go take the survey. And he linked that out. And he said the change worked really well. He now gets, he continues to get the same amount of emails, and he now gets a good percentage of people taking the survey. And so he basically went from trying to do parallel to serial processing, right? He's now doing it in series. I love this idea. I've done this before with wanting people to take an action and struggling with it. I did the same thing. I put them both on the page, and I knew before I launched, I knew it just wasn't the right thing to do, you know, to have these two calls to action. There's no they're going to do one or the other, and you're going to lose them. And so changing it up and giving them that second call to action after they've already done the first, I just think it's a golden tip. So I want to thank Sean Murphy again, and we will get back to him. I think he has another question in our queue somewhere that we'll probably answer in the next few shows. Okay, our next question is about having a physical address. It's from Richard Kolkovich at sigil.org. It says, hi guys, I've been enjoying the podcast since the beginning, and I regularly refer to Rob's book whenever I can grab some time to work on my startup idea. I'm in the process of getting my mailing list and landing page set up correctly. According to Canned Spam, I have to have a physical email address to associate with the mailing list, or so MailChimp tells me. How do you guys handle this? Earth Class Mail is not cheap. It's $25 to get started and $20 a month. I'm trying to spend as little as I need before I have income, especially for things like this that are not directly related to the product. Thanks for your time and keep up the great work on the podcast.
You know, Rob uses Earth Class Mail and I use Mailbox Forwarding, which at the time was only $10 a month. I think the cost for that has gone up to $15 a month. So I'm still fortunately on their $10 a month plan, but I get virtually zero mail. And that address is really just to satisfy those mailing requirements that for the canned spam laws. The other thing you can use it for is if you get, and I haven't tried this yet, but I'm expecting that it would work for like the extended validation for SSL certificates, but I'm hoping that that'll pull through for me.
Got it. Yeah. So I also use it for domain registrations because I have so many, you know, gazillion domains out there. So
I used to use a proxy for that.
Oh, do you? Okay. Yeah. But that's extra money, right? That's like $7-$8 per domain.
No. Like if you do it through DreamHost, it doesn't cost you anything. They do it for free.
Oh, how cool. Okay, so I'm through GoDaddy, which if you've heard about the SOPA boycott, I'm thinking about hopping from them. But yeah, no, I have, I don't know, what is it, 70, 80 domains through Dream or through GoDaddy. So yeah. I try to keep them all registered in one place. And yeah, they charge, of course, I don't even know what it is, $7 a year or something for a proxy to keep it private. See, I actually like, that's interesting. When it's proxy, does it show up as being private? Because when I see that in the domain registry, I get a little bit of a red flag because I'm like, huh, is that person trying to hide something?
It shows up in the Whois listing as some sort of proxy. It actually says proxy in it.
Got it. Okay, so I would then prefer to have just a normal address instead of a proxy because my experience dealing with like affiliate marketing, and there are some kind of shadier neighborhoods of affiliate marketing, and people always use those private registrations because they don't want to give an address. So if I were to search for Whois and see it, most people probably won't see it, but my inclination would be like, ding, huh, a little bit of a red flag there.
Right.
So if I already had, I mean, that's one of the big reasons I got an address is because I wanted to be able to put one there and not have to use a proxy.
I think it's because you're more technical. Let me ask you a question. I assume you bought Beyond Compare, right? We talked about that before. Did you go do a Whois lookup on them before you bought the product?
I totally didn't. So. No. And I don't typically do that.
Right. And that's my point. Yeah, yeah. I don't think in the vast majority of cases it actually matters.
But Richard's question, so mailbox forwarding is $15 a month. You can go down and get a P.O. box for, is it $100 a year?
Something for the smallest like that.
Yeah, the post office is actually quite cheap, and if you only use it for domain registrations and or, you know, this the mail stuff, you won't get mail there, and you don't ever have to check it.
You'll still get junk mail, though, I think.
That's the reason why I went with Earth Class Mail, even though it's more expensive than the post office, is because I never, everything's scanned in, and it, you know, emails me a GIF of the front, and I can see if it's junk mail, and if it is, I just recycle it, and if it's not, because a few things have come through based on like state filings I've made that have actually been, I want it, and so then I can have them forwarded to me, or they'll scan them in and I can just print them out at home.
Yeah.
So that's nice. But I get Richard's point, right? He doesn't want to pay $240 a year on something he really doesn't want. You know, he doesn't want to have to use. Fifth and final question is from Matthew Holmes, and it's about getting started in programming. And it says, thanks for the great podcast. It's excellent content. Your insights have been great. I'm probably somewhat different than most of your listeners in that I'm coming from a place of more experience with marketing and zero to little experience with programming. I was wondering if you could do an episode of resources for those getting started in programming. I'm teaching myself PHP MySQL, and I'm having some success using Tizag.com and W3Plus looking at blogs for specific questions. But I can't help but feel I'm missing the overall big picture, basic grounding information. It's not feasible for me to return to school, so any tips would be appreciated. Many thanks, Matthew. Okay, so I have so many thoughts on this. My first thought is, if you know marketing, why are you going back to learn programming? Like, why do you need to do that? Because in my opinion, having the marketing experience is, that's the really hard part. Outsourcing marketing, really hard. Outsourcing development, not nearly as hard, even if you are not a developer yourself. If you get a basic idea of what it takes to do PHP MySQL and you have decent project management skills, I would not learn it myself. I just think it's a time investment that could be spent doing other things.
Well, I wonder if the issue is that, and this may very well apply to most people, is that, you know, you want to get started building your own products and marketing them, and you've got maybe the marketing experience, but you've got no real background in programming. So how do you get something built? Well, you and I would look at that and say, well, outsource it, pay somebody to do it. What if you don't have the money to actually pay somebody to go do it? I mean, you're kind of in between a rock and a hard place where how do you get started without money to get started? Because, you know what I'm getting at?
I do. No, totally. And we've actually talked specifically about this. So obviously there's two resources you need. You need one or the other. You need time or you need money to get this thing going. So if you have an exorbitant amount of time, I mean a lot of time, maybe 15 to 20 hours a week to teach yourself programming, then go do that. But if you're trying to learn programming on 5 hours a week, you're nuts. There's no chance. I remember I went through college, I got a computer engineering degree, which although it was more hardware focused, I had programming classes. I've been writing code since I was 8. And when I got out and tried to build my first web app, I had no idea how to do it. It took me weeks and weeks of nights and weekends to figure out how to build the app. Then I got my first job doing it. I was doing it 40 hours a week. And I learned more in a month than I had in the previous 5-10 years of trying to do stuff. Once I had a real product I was actually trying to build. All that to say, it is super time intensive to learn how to program if you've never done it. It's very, I mean, very time intensive. And so I would encourage that if, unless you have a huge amount of time and absolutely no money, I would encourage you not to learn how to do it. If you have even a few $1,000 and you are a little more strapped for time, I would lean towards trying to become more of the entrepreneur, of a project manager and a marketer, and finding someone solid on Odesk who can build the product and then keep them around for maintenance and upgrades and stuff. What I'm trying to think is the amount of money that you need to get started reasonably well, right? And I don't know what that number is. I think it depends a lot on what you're trying to build. I think if you're trying to build iPhone apps, you can get them fairly cheap because they're so small and self-contained. And if you're trying to build some big SaaS application, I would say that you may be going down a bad path. If this is really your first app that you're going to build yourself and you have an idea for a really big app, I would suggest paring it down or figuring out a different idea and finding something that can be built for under $5,000 through a contractor. What do you think, Mike? Do you think I'm too heavy-handed here?
I don't think so. I think to become good at programming, it takes a while. In your argument, you come across very strong on it, and I don't necessarily feel compelled to argue against you because, you know, I've got that computer engineering background just as well as you do. And I think that the marketing side is, I mean, I think we both agree on that the marketing side is a lot more important than the code. I mean, you look at any enterprise software companies out there, and if you look under the covers at the stuff that they've got, most of it's crap.
No, I think you're right.
The fact is, it's not very good code and it's not very well written. And it's because those companies understand that they're not selling code. They're selling a product. And if some things don't work, okay, well, the support department can handle that. And I understand that, you know, when you've got your own product, you've got to deal with everything. But what sells a product is not the product. It's the marketing behind it.
This is our 62nd episode. I feel like we've said that at least once per episode for 62 episodes. That is our theme. I mean, it really is. And we have nothing, like we are coders. We love to code. If I had my dream job, it would be like to code half time and do other stuff the other half. Like I love doing it. The drive to code or the everyone thinks they need to learn how to code to start a startup. And coders think that's all they need to know how to do to start a startup. And we are basically here to say, no, it's kind of the opposite.
I'll be honest, it's painful to say that that's not the case. It really is, you know, because as a programmer, I want to say, yeah, the code is important. And the reality is it's in many ways, it's not. I mean, even for Audit Shark, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good engineering and effort that went into it. But at the end of the day, it's not going to sell itself. It's all the marketing effort that goes around with it.
Right. It's important that you have some code. Just getting it done and you having learned to code to write it is not the critical part that's going to make your business succeed.
Okay. And I think that if you go down the path of doing the marketing stuff up front and validating that there is a market for it, it's a lot easier to plunk down $5,000 that you are keeping close for, you know, a rainy day or you really can't necessarily afford to spend it. But if you've got validation of a market and you know that there's a market there for that product, then it's a little bit easier of a pill to swallow to pay somebody to go do it, even though maybe it's your last $5,000. But if you know that there's a market for it, it's not so bad because you can be relatively confident that you're getting it back. It's not like you're going to Vegas and putting $5,000 on black.
Yeah, I totally agree. Instead of spending 10 to 20 hours a week for 6 months, and in fact, if you don't know how to code, it's going to take 3 months to figure yourself out and then 6 months to build it. So I bet I would put you in 9 months of 10 to 20 hours a week to build this thing. And it is going to be such a hard road. Instead of doing that, I fully agree with what Mike said. Go out, do some lean startup stuff, cold call some customers, talk to people, get some data, get some demand, get your first 5 customers lined up. Once you've done that, you can either be more confident that you can drop the money, or with that data, that's the kind of stuff that you need to go to a developer and say, look, let's start a company together. Going to a developer now and asking to partner with him him or her is not going to work. I get this question, honestly, once a week. I get an email through my blog or my book or whatever, and someone says, I'm non-technical, how do I find a co-founder? And I always tell them, it is very hard when you're not a technical co-founder. What you need to bring to the table is marketing experience. You need to have proven experience. You need to show people, look, you brought these years of coding experience. I bring all this valuable marketing stuff, and I validated the idea. I know it's going to work. Let's do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're such a leg up. Like, go out and hustle before you want to build the product. Like, build the product last. Figure all this other stuff out first.
Mm-hmm. That's all I have to say about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, seriously. So that, we answered 5 questions this time. We still have a big backlog. I don't know, next episode, that'll be all questions or not, but we appreciate everyone joining us, and we wish everyone a happy new year. This should be out just a couple days after the new year, and then we'll resume our normal schedule starting next week.
And if you have not done so and you're interested, please go to www.microconf.com and sign up for the mailing list to find out about when MicroConf 2012 will actually be. And you can get on, you'll be on the mailing list and get some of the first notifications of when tickets come out. Other than that, if you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsthestrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can also subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.